Well, this morning we conclude our treatment of the Torah. We've watched the so-called Deuteronomic school develop the Book of Deuteronomy and other books, covering about 300 years of development. Then we looked at the priestly school, who were responsible for most of Exodus, Leviticus, and Deuteronomy. And that brings us to the last of the books of the Torah, this unique book called the Book of Genesis. It's divided into two very clearly marked sections, and we're going to start with the second, the patriarchal narrative from Genesis 12 to Genesis 50. No doubt there were stories handed down in the various tribal areas of ancestors such as Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, and Joseph. Some of these stories may even have found a written form. In any case, when the refugees poured into Jerusalem after the fall of Samaria in 721 BC, they would have brought their stories about Jacob, a northern ancestor, inverted commas, and Joseph with them. Judah had its own stories about an ancient ancestor called Abraham and Isaac. Now, no doubt these stories encouraged King Josiah, who saw himself as realizing the promise made by Yahweh way back to the patriarchs. I will give you a land, etc. What better motivation could he have had than a sense of destiny that he was the one in the last part of the 600th, 7th century to carry out and achieve the promise made in that ancestral time? Elements of the patriarchal narrative may have been composed to support the aspirations of King Josiah in the late 7th century. As it stands, this swathe of chapters from 12 to 50 of Genesis is a post-exilic composition, an imaginary reconstruction of the patriarchal period. For the authors wanted their contemporaries to relate their experiences after the exile, back in this tiny little Yehud or Judah, post-exilic Judah. They wanted them to relate their experiences to that of their ancestors. So they're imagining this narrative. Scholars call these stories archaizing legends. Pretty good title, I think, for them. Now, a major problem facing the returned exiles is that those who'd not gone into exile, on the whole, subsistence farmers, the poorest people, the returning exiles wanted to reclaim their land. Of course, no one thought they'd ever come back, so other people moved into their properties, which is exactly what you do. Land that others had occupied in their absence, thinking they'd never come back. But the returned exiles wanted to reclaim their father or their grandfather's property. The returning exiles identified closely, as you can imagine, with Moses, coming out of a land of captivity, across a desert to the promised land. Those who'd stayed in the land identified with Abraham. They'd always been there, and they identified with their ancient ancestor. A key reason for composing the Pentateuch was to form a united people. It was imperative that both groups come to see that the God who revealed himself to Moses was the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. So that brings us all in: northern area Israel, southern area Judah, return. turned exiles and the ones that stayed in the land. They're all one people. And that's what the book of Genesis will be establishing in these archaizing legends. Another factor was their desire to demonstrate that the ancient traditions had an ongoing value for the post-exilic members of Judah. They preserved the ancient material not as museum pieces, but because they saw it as a revelation from God, and they trusted that these legends, stories, could still guide them. So they attempted to point this out in the way they told the stories, and now wrote the stories in the way they commented on the text. They didn't want their contemporaries to get caught up in nostalgia for the past. That's not what they're doing. It was important that they live now in a way that was faithful to God and that would avoid the mistakes of the past, for which they paid such a heavy price. The destruction of the city, destruction of the temple, end of the dynasty. I mean, it's a stunning period in their history. That was the price they paid for not being faithful to Yahweh. So we're going to find these archaizing legends, Yahweh, Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, promise, etc. In spite of many attempts, it has proved impossible to establish a precise time in history that we can confidently call the period of the patriarchs. No clear historical links can be drawn from what we know about ancient migrations, from the nomadic lifestyle of the patriarchs, from the customs that we find in the stories themselves, or from the place names or personal names in the accounts. All we can say, and by we I mean the scholars investigating all this, all we can say is that the stories refer to a time prior to the tribes of Israel, who lived in Canaan in the 13th century BC. The 19th century BC, that is the 1800s, has been suggested as a likely time that they're going back to. Let's start then with Abraham, chapters 12 to 25 of the book of Genesis. So we begin with the stories about Abraham. As we read these stories, we should expect to find indications of the interests and concerns of the people who told and listened to these stories over hundreds of years of storytelling. It's likely that as single units, some of these stories were committed to writing prior to the fall of Jerusalem and the exile, in which case they would express some of the interests and concerns of that period. However, our main interest is in post-exilic Judah, when those responsible for the written text of Genesis, as we have it, composed and included and knitted together these various legends from the various tribal areas. Our main concern will be to place ourselves back in Judah, having experienced the collapse of Jerusalem, etc., and the exile, that we're going to find those resonating through the text as we have them. But, as I've said, some of it will be material that was written earlier, so it'll represent earlier understandings, during the time of Josiah, for example. All we know of Abraham is in the Bible text. There are no inscriptions, no documents outside the Bible, no monuments that speak of Abraham. Some of these stories may have inspired the people of Judah as they grew into a tribe, as they became a kingdom, and as they found themselves caught between the aspirations of Egypt and the kingdoms of Mesopotamia, both of which appear in these legends. And they experienced the exile and were trying to rebuild after the exile. The stories of the patriarchs have continued to inspire the Jewish people and the Christian communities ever since. They were also sacred to those Jews who became disciples of Jesus. And through them, they've continued to be treasured as stories of the origin of the Christian community. Similarly, for the people of Islam, some centuries later, they are descended from the other son, Ishmael, of Abraham. We are invited to allow our imagination to be captured by these stories, in the hope that they may inspire us to, as Paul says in Romans chapter 4, to share the faith of Abraham, the father of us all. A phrase of Paul himself. So in reading these stories, we're in touch with the questions, the dreams, the hopes, the disappointments of post-exilic Judah. Don't need to stress this, I suppose. We're not getting a history of what happened in the 19th century BC. We're actually addressing people in the 4th century BC and their concerns. And that's what the stories, as they've been developed and put together and focused, that's what they're about. These people have been through the destruction of their city and the terrible experience of exile. As they understood it, this was because they'd broken the covenant made with Moses. It was important for them to remember that there was an older promise. Okay, we've mucked up the Moses thing, but there was an older promise, an unconditional one given by God to the patriarchs. And that survives and sustains them. A promise made by God that transcended human fidelity or infidelity. Abram believed it. So must they, for in their faith lay their hope. Abram is held up to the reader as a model, a flawed one who had a lot to learn, but one who reached a heroic degree of faith and obedience, such that we can look to him as what Paul calls our father in faith. Romans chapter 4, verse 3 reads, "What does Scripture say? Abraham," and he quotes, "Abraham believed God, and it was reckoned to him as righteousness." Paul is arguing that the law which we've transcended now and which has been set aside because it's done its job, there's something more ancient than the law. It's the faith of Abraham in God's unconditional promise. That's what we've got to hold on to. We let the law go, but we don't let faith go. Faith in the God of our ancestors. Acts chapter 7, verse 3. This is Stephen, in the speech created by Luke, of course. Reads, "God said to Abraham, 'Leave your country and your relatives and go to the land I will show you.'" Galatians 3, 8. "The scripture, foreseeing that God would justify the Gentiles by faith," the faith of Jesus, of course, now given, "declared the gospel beforehand to Abraham, saying, 'All the Gentiles shall be blessed in you.'" All the Gentiles. All this stuff is so important to the early Christians, because they were taking their Judaism to the world. And certainly it's to the world, because way back before Moses, before Judaism, etc., was this ancient promise, which was Abraham was going to be father to all the Gentiles, and all the nations are going to be blessed in Abram. What a lovely support for the Jews who dared to reach out to the world. People like Paul and Stephen himself, of course. Hebrews chapter 7, verse 1 reads, "This King Melchizedek of Salem," it's Jerusalem, priest of the Most High God, met Abram as he was returning from defeating the kings and blessed him and said, and to him Abram apportioned one-tenth of everything. I can't go into all that with you. That's from Genesis 14, the story of Melchizedek, but that comes in then applied to Jesus, who becomes the high priest. That was a difficult thing to do in the New Testament because Jesus was a layman, of course. But Hebrews brilliantly enabled us to see Jesus as the fulfillment of the whole priestly journey too, because he is the high priest, and priests in the church, that's us, all the baptized, are according to the order of Melchizedek, not according to the order of the Levitical priests. This is a missionary priesthood that we share as baptized Christians. Jesus, the priest who is the king, Melchizedek, king of Salem, bringing about the reign of God. Romans 4:17, Paul writes, as it is written, I have made you the father of many nations in the presence of the God in whom he believed. Romans 9:9, this is what the promise said, about this time I will return and Sarah shall have a son. So Paul's frequently quoting, obviously, from the book of Genesis, the patriarchal narratives, because he needs to go prior to, superior to, earlier than the Torah, to see the God as the God of the whole world and the God who's going to love the world through Abraham and his descendants. Hebrews 11:12, from one person, and this one as good as dead, this is Abraham, he's 140 or something, descendants were born, quote from Genesis, as many as the stars of heaven and as innumerable grains of sand by the seashore. And the Christian world, rightly, well, they didn't want this limited to the cult, the worship, the laws, the temple, the sacrifices of Judaism. This is bigger than that. Abram was bigger than that, and the promise was bigger than that. So he wants the whole world to be part of this family, this Abram's family. Isaac. Very little of Isaac in the book of Genesis. Genesis 25 to 26 only. Not all those chapters, those two chapters either. But Isaac does appear. There must have been little legends about him somewhere in one of the southern parts of Judah, on the edges of things. In any case, he's drawn into it as well, obviously. Here, I'll read to you from Matthew. I am the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, and the God of Jacob. He is God, not of the dead, but of the living. Isaac includes the living meaning, of course. If God is the God of the living, and he's the God of these, they must be still living. Because he's the God of the living, not the dead. So somehow beyond death, this is Jesus using this, church using this as an argument against the Sadducees who didn't believe in life after death. Acts 3:13, the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, the God of Jacob, the God of our ancestors has glorified his servant Jesus. This is Peter's speech on the day of Pentecost to the community. Galatians, you, my friends, are children of the promise, like Isaac, you people of Galatia. The promise came from Abraham to Isaac, it's come from Abraham to you. Hebrews 11:20, by faith Isaac invoked blessings for the future of Jacob and Esau. And James, the letter of James 2:21, was not our ancestor Abraham justified by works when he offered his son Isaac on the altar? And you know that story. All the countries around about, one of the things they did out of fear of their gods was they had a sense that if you give the most precious thing to you've got to God, they'll be satisfied. Don't give them the second or the third, but your most precious. Well, the most precious thing they had was their firstborn child. So the Moabites used to kill, offer in murder, offer in sacrifice to the Moloch, this angry, bloodthirsty god, their firstborn, and then Moloch would be satisfied and look after them. That's how they saw it. Well, it's pretty hard not to get caught up in that world. So the Israelites had a similar feeling. They should give up their most precious possession. So in the story, this story puts an end to it, of course. The story of Abraham, he thinks he's got to do that too. So he takes Isaac, and I know you know the story, up onto the mountain, ready to sacrifice him. But then God intervenes and says, stop. That's not the kind of God I am. That's not the kind of God Yahweh is. And God supplies him a ram. So the animal, the best of the animals from last year's flock, becomes a substitute. And God is perfectly content with this precious, beautiful, pure, whatever, lamb or kid for the sacrifice, but not your child. So it's a powerful story. And they needed stories to bolster them against all that was going on around them. Jacob, Genesis 27 to 35. This is a story not so much about Jacob as about God, who's faithful to his promises and his blessing, brought about through the weak human beings that he's chosen. Jacob is quite a crook. When you read it, you'll know that. It's about God who'll not be bound by our conventions. The firstborn was the one to inherit the promise. Okay, that's the system. God has the promise going to the second. What's going on? God is free. He doesn't fit into our little long customs that we've got. They're there. God can surprise us, and he does, by making the promise go to the second born, that is, Jacob. And I presume you know the story, and you can read it later. This is about God who's free, for whom the first will be last, and the last first. This is a story about God who chooses what is low and despised in the world, things that are not, to reduce to nothing things that are. So this literature is constantly getting the people who read it to be ready for God to surprise them and not lock God into our traditional ways of looking at things. This is a story, the story of Jacob, about God who has a preferential option for the poor and hears their cry. All that's coming into these lovely legends. The favoured position of Rachel's sons, Joseph and Benjamin, and the significant role of Bethel suggest this important sanctuary of the northern kingdom of Israel as a likely centre for the gathering and propagating of the stories about Jacob. Joseph covered pretty well the whole of Samaria. Ephraim, Manasseh, and then Joseph's brother of the favourite wife of Jacob took the little bit just above Jerusalem. So they had the whole of the Samaritan hill country. This is supported by the fact that the prophet Hosea, in the latter part of the 8th century, shows that he is acquainted with a number of the stories found here in Genesis. In words of warning to the southern kingdom of Judah and the northern kingdom, Jacob, Hosea has this to say, quoting from Hosea chapter 12. Yahweh has an indictment against Judah and will punish Jacob according to his ways and repay him according to his deeds, says this prophet who's at the time of the collapse of Samaria. In the womb, he tried to supplant his brother, and in his manhood, he strove with God. Story of Jacob fighting this very strange figure at the Jabbok River to get into the Promised Land. He had to kind of struggle, fight his way in. And we're not quite sure what that angel of night, or was it Yahweh, but he's fighting with God, and that's where he gets his name Israel, the one who struggles with God. Again, back to Hosea. He strove with the angel and prevailed. He wept and sought his favour. He met him at Bethel. Remember when he lay on the rock and woke up and there's a ladder between heaven and earth and all those wonderful stories. He met him at Bethel and there he spoke with him. Yahweh, the God of hosts, Yahweh is his name. But as for you, says Hosea, return to your God, hold fast to love and justice, and wait continually for your God. Jacob fled to the land of Aram, Syria. There Israel served for a wife, and for a wife he guarded sheep. The story's got little comical elements to it. He worked for 7 years to get Rachel, and when he finished his 7 years hard work, he went up to Rachel's father, and the father tricked him into going to bed and sleeping with his elder daughter that he couldn't marry off, Leah. So then Jacob wanted Rachel, so he had to work for 7 more years to get Rachel. So dads do these kind of things, I'm told. So that's the story. Humour, but it's all part of it. But what I'm trying to prove here is, here we have, at the end of the 8th century BC, Hosea is quite aware of one or two of these stories. So the stories clearly go back, even though they're brought together in the post-exilic period. The authors of Genesis tell how Jacob and his sons came to Egypt. This sets the scene for the story of Moses. As with the earlier sections, into their narrative they incorporate stories that have come down from the various sacred tribal centres of North and South. There's the Joseph story, which is a slab of literature on its own. Could be quite ancient. That's Genesis 37 to 50. What sets this section apart from the previous two of the patriarchal narrative is that the authors also incorporate a separate literary composition focusing on Joseph. The Joseph story is not a compilation of separate stories. It's a unified literary production, unlike anything we've met so far in the patriarchal narrative. There's as yet no consensus among scholars as to when the Joseph story was composed. It seems to arise out of and be directed to a community that's concerned with ongoing struggles within the family. I have to assume you know the story basically of Joseph. And with public political concerns, a community in which God's action is hidden. It's a story that urges the community to hold on to the dream. Joseph was a man of dreams. Assuring them that it will come true against the odds. And Joseph, the slave, dropped in, then carted off, ends up being in charge of Egypt. Not the Pharaoh, but the Pharaoh's right-hand man running the whole show. That's the story. It explores the question, should one brother rule over others? The focus on Joseph points to the northern kingdom, which is the tribes of Joseph, Ephraim and Manasseh. Egypt is presented in very positive light in the story of Joseph. Does this indicate that at the time of writing, the author was looking to Egypt to come to Israel's rescue against Assyria? Possibly, likely. The questions that are explored in the Joseph story were ones also being asked during the exile, when the inclination was to blame the monarchy for the collapse of Jerusalem and so for the exile. Right government is a matter that concerns us all. So they're concerned with right government. So Pharaoh, Joseph, the sons coming down, etc. Well, that's the patriarchal story, as briefly as I can put it to you. Now we get into this absolutely stunning material, the first 11 chapters of the book of Genesis. I'd love to have a week just to do this. In fact, I've done this alone for a whole week. It is such amazing literature. There you've got in front of you God, the creation of Adam. But since I didn't see it for a while, I mean, I've seen it for a few years, It's called, it's Michelangelo, as you know, Creation of Adam. And I saw God and I saw Adam, and I thought that was the creation of Adam. Can you see somebody there that's not one of the angels? That's Eve. Adam in Hebrew means humankind. It's a general word. Homo in Latin, not male or female, just the creation of the human race. That's what this is about. And there's Adam, obviously. There's God, and Adam's looking a bit, I don't know, reluctant or something. The hand isn't exactly. And I think Adam is actually not looking at God so much. He's thinking of this. The first words of a human being in the book of Genesis are Zut, meaning, well, you can hear it down at train layers, Zut, when God brings to, it's not good for to be alone. So God brings all the animals, and Adam names them, but he's not that interested in them. And then suddenly he goes to sleep, as you know, and from near his heart a rib is taken, and the rib is formed into woman, because she comes from man, as the story is. And then Adam wakes up and he says effectively, "Now, God, you know what you're doing. Good, you've got it right. Wow, zut," he says. And I'm sure you all know what that means. Let's look at it. It's likely that it was after the return from exile that scribes from the various schools composed this literature. It offers a perspective on the ancient Semitic myths about creation and primeval history, stories that they heard over in Babylon when they were in exile. This is not certain, but it's probable. From the perspective of the Israelite faith. So they heard stories of floods. We know that we found them since Gilgamesh, etc. These stories, they came up, but they wanted to say, wow, but these stories aren't good enough. They retold them, but they retold them from the point of view of their faith in Yahweh. During the Babylonian exile, the exiles came in contact with the religious ideas and cult of Babylon. They were stunned at how primitive it all was. They didn't, in Israel, there are high mountains and that God can be on the mountain, and they go over to this place in between the two rivers, the Mesopotamia area. Of course, it's alluvial plains. There's no mountains there. And they had to create their own mountain to put their God on, the God of the moon. And so they've built these Tower of Babel, you know, ziggurat, they call, and they know about these. They built them up and put their god on the top. God, it's hopeless. And their gods were kind of, well, you know, from the Psalms, from Isaiah too, of the period. They're made of stone and they're made of wood, and they can have eyes, but they can't see, and they have ears, can't hear. So they were impressed with Babylon's culture, but not religiously. It was so wacko and so primitive, whereas their God was mysterious, awesome, couldn't have bits of wood showing it. While in Babylon, the exiles had come into contact with myths about the beginning of the world and the human race. Myths like that of Atrahasis, composed in the ancient Akkadian language of the 17th century BC, and the Enuma Elish of the 12th century BC. These myths spoke of the genesis of the gods, the beginnings of humanity, and the privileged place of course, Babylon. His god was Marduk in that world. The first 11 chapters of Genesis presents an alternative view of creation, of the origins of humankind, and of the presence and action of God in the world, a view that's inspired by the distinctive faith of Yahweh, and in the special relationship of God to Israel. The literature is just stands out compared to anything contemporary. Scholars discern two different kinds of material in these chapters 1 to 11. recognisable by their different styles, their different interests, and their themes. We have an account of creation, culminating in the blessing of the seventh day, the Sabbath. No guessing that that would come from the priests. The story of the flood, a priestly variation of it. A number of genealogies. They love genealogies because they, the more ancient your family went back, the more important you were. And notice all the genealogies are male. They have to be, because they had no understanding of the contribution of the female to the human being. And they all assumed, in fact everyone in their world assumed, that the male seed was actually a human being in Tiny, and that the male gave that human being to the woman, who then, like the earth, nurtured it and cared for it, etc. But it wasn't. So the male was the only one who handed on life through the female. Now, they were wrong, of course, but that was their understanding. So the genealogies are all male. These have the distinctive style of the priestly school. There's also a story of the beginning of the human race which looks at the human condition in the light of Israel's faith and includes the story of Adam and Eve, Cain and Abel, another version of the flood story, very different from the priestly one, and the story of the Tower of Babel, Babel, Babylon, Ziggurat, what they've just witnessed, and that's from the Yahwist. So if we're going to talk about a Yahwist as a person or a theologian, or this is where I think he belongs, and this is why God is called Yahweh God in these early chapters. In post-exilic Judah, the authors of Genesis 1 to 11 have blended this material into one continuous narrative. Both strands are composed as counters to the primeval myths encountered in Babylon during the exile, and they declare that the God of Israel, Yahweh, is the creator of the universe and the Lord of history. An extraordinary statement to make from a tiny people who are a little bit of a whopping big Persian Empire, don't have their own government, don't have their own rulers, very subject, and of course landlocked, trade wasn't working for them. So they're a very poverty-stricken group, and they're saying, in spite of all that everyone else is saying, it's not the God of Babylon that is the creator of the world, it's our God, Yahweh. So they're making the biggest claim you can make for their ancient history and the one who called them into being a people. The material found in Genesis 1 to 11 is not history, as we understand the word. The authors don't narrate historical events. At the same time, it's not myth. For myth sets out to describe a stable and unchanging situation, usually supported by the cult, by the worship, and one that inevitably favours the power exercised by the ruler who's presented as divine. And you find that everywhere, Mesopotamia, Egypt, all around. A myth is there to support the status quo. This doesn't do that. Genesis 1 to 11 has a different focus. It's on God as creator, on God's relationship with creation, and especially with the human race, and on how God must, people must live if they're going to benefit from the blessing of God. The text expresses inspired insights into God's design for creation, into why it is that God's design is sometimes thwarted by human sin. The kind of sin that is highlighted comes from reflection on the kind of sin that brought about the destruction of Jerusalem and the exile. It's Hamas, violence. The post-exilic authors wanted their contemporaries to learn the right lessons so as not to repeat the sin of their ancestors. It was important for the authors of Genesis to state that their God, the God of Israel, was the one who created the universe. the destruction of Jerusalem, the exile in Babylon, the fact that the community in Judah after the exile was still under the control of a foreign power, could have led some to think that Yahweh, the God of Israel, was less powerful, less significant than the gods of Babylon or Persia, Cyrus. Some in exile were tempted to despair. I'll read to you from Isaiah 49, written at the time. Oh, this is Ezekiel first, also belongs to the exile. Our bones are dried up, our hope is lost, we're cut off completely, cries Ezekiel chapter 37, reflecting the mood of his contemporaries. So it was for those left back in Judah. And here's from Isaiah. Yahweh has forsaken me. My Lord has forgotten me. Again, Isaiah. My way is hidden from Yahweh. My right is disregarded by my God. They're in a state of near despair. The authors wanted to state that their God, the God of Israel, the only true God, is the creator of the universe, including the nations that have defeated them in battle and under whose authority they now live. So live under it. God's running it all, in their view. So it will all come good because God's promises made back then to Abraham will be fulfilled for us. The authors chose, therefore, to introduce the primeval narrative, indeed the whole of the Torah, with a magnificent, dramatic piece that said exactly this. There are indications that they were aware of the Mesopotamian creation myths that they'd encountered in exile. Indeed, the image of the land and its human inhabitants coming to life out of the chaos of flooding waters, that story parallels what we find in the ancient myths. It's not a Palestinian image. Can't have started there with mountains, and there's no flooding going on ever in Palestine. So the stories of floods and all this, clearly they come from somewhere else. And they kept the story but reshaped it. The myths of the Mesopotamia begin with the Genesis of the gods. Not so the opening chapters of Genesis. God doesn't come from anything. It begins with God, the only God identified as Yahweh, the God of Israel, and it begins with creation as we know it, the place where human beings live out their lives. The stars, worshipped as divine in Babylon, are declared to be creatures of God. They don't even name the sun and the moon, which were worshipped everywhere. They are just the big stars and the little stars. They name them as things. Whatever power the Babylonians might wield, the people of Israel needn't envy them, for whatever exists owes its being to our God, the God of Israel. In Genesis 2, so that's the first story, day one, day two, Acts, of course, in the poetic drama, all priestly stuff, ends at 2:4. Then another story begins, a more simple story, not a cultic song to be sung, but a story, a legend. In Genesis 2:4, we're not sharing in privileged information that gives us the names of the first human couple, Adam and Eve, and describes how they actually lived in paradise before they sinned. Rather, we have a reflection on what it means to be human, set in contrast to the myths of the ancient Near East and from the perspective of Israel's faith. We're offered a reflection on what life could be. The paradise of Eden is what God wanted from God's hands. That's what the world is meant to be. It never was. And why wasn't it that way? Because human sin got in the road. So it's not one stage and then a fall and then another stage. It's a dream. It's saying, hey, this is the kind of world that God creates. Why isn't it happening? Because we're not listening. We're sinning. We're violent. We're etc., etc., etc. So they're not stages here. And that's the same, by the way, in the book of Revelation at the end of the New Testament. The final chapters there are all about a new heaven and a new earth, a wedding banquet, a paradise. So the paradise was the way God wanted the world to be, and from God it would be. It was good. It was very good. Hang on, the world we're in is not always good and not always very good. Why not? The story of human sin gets in the road and stops it happening. But we can create our paradise. We're offered a reflection on what life could be like if only we listened to God. God could be walking in the garden with us. And when God is walking in the garden, he says, what's going on? Adam, where are you? And Adam's hiding from God. In Genesis 2:4, we're not sure. The account no doubt reflects on legends of the patriarchs and on Israel's history, but it's a story which aims to help build a harmonious community in Judah by pointing out the kind of behaviour that must be avoided to be faithful to God's covenant and live the kind of life willed by God. The authors make no attempt to tell how evil came into the world. And it's not a story of Satan, it's a story of a snake. It's a fable. And the snake goes... And when you read the Hebrew, of course, it's got a lot of that in it, as the snake talks. Which you can't hear in the English translation. If I had it here, I could read it to you, but I didn't bring it. So it's a fable about a snake. And why does a snake have to crawl on its belly and eat dust? It doesn't eat dust, I'm told. But everyone thought it did, it seems to. And that's because God punished it for what it did to Eve. And why does Eve, when she has children, have pain? You wouldn't think you'd have pain having children. That's God's punishment for her for what she did. And why is Adam kicked out of the garden? Because of what he did. It's all part of the story. Death is obviously, by the way, God says, if you eat, you know, there are two trees in the middle of the garden. And God says, if you eat from this tree, the tree of good and evil, then you will die. That's no doubt about it. They eat from the tree, and God's a bit, oh God, help us. So he doesn't, they don't die, they just, they're sent out of the garden, but they die eventually. We're all going to die. But they were going to die, you know, on the spot if they behave badly. And the threat of God, God weakens and softens. And you remember when they made these fig leaves to cover their nakedness? And God looked at them, a pair of them, and says, in a lovely bit of the story, God says, oh, God, is that the best they can do? So God up in heaven knits them all little lap-laps and brings them down and gives one to Eve and one to Adam to help them be a bit more modest than they could manage with a fig leaf. God's a very caring God, and he never carries out his threats. He's always adapting to our... It's all in the story there. That's how you're meant to read the story, and you're meant to laugh your way through the story, and you're meant to get the impression of a God who's telling us what to do, because it's important that we do it, but when we don't do it, he softens and does something a bit, but not as bad. The text does say something about human folly, but as we should expect, the focus of the text is on God and on God's response to our folly. It's amazingly loving. A lesson the returned exiles need to hear. We've been through all this, but our God is still the creator. He still loves us. It'll be fine. The narrative reminds them and continues to remind us that we're destined to live in God's world and in dependence on God. The problem was not that Eve and Adam were fed from the tree of life. Of course they were. But they were supposed to wait on God to do it. Instead of that, they reached up, grabbed the fruit, and pulled it as though they could run it. They did it. And you remember Paul's beautiful hymn in Philippians where he says, Jesus was not like that. He didn't reach up and grasp at equality with God. He wasn't doing it. He welcomed God, accepted God, made space for God, opened himself to God. But God is the giver. We're not the controlling ones doing it. That's all in the story. The text insists that the Creator is their own Yahweh, the one who hears the cry of the poor. Cain does a dreadful thing to Abel. The farmers and the city dwellers and the ironmongers had done dreadful things to the poor pastoralists who had little power and just their sheep and goats. So that's going on all the time. And here it is represented by these two, did dreadful things. And is there going to be revenge? No. God puts a mark on Cain. No one's to touch Cain. Jihad is not part of it. Revenge is not part of it. Because it was part of their world. You hurt my family, we're going to hurt yours. And the Bible says, no, you don't. That's not it. Leave that to God. Your job is not to do that. But Cain is protected. The sinner is protected by God from the violence of the people trying to get back at him. The effects of our sin portrayed here as punishment can be corrective because of the mercy of God, but we cannot go on sinning without suffering sin's consequences. And they do go on sinning, and it gets to the stage where the firmament collapses, and that's the end. We're right back to, in the beginning God said, let there be light. It's all gone. Light is still there, but the rest's all gone. The firmament's gone. The earth's gone, the heavens have collapsed, stars are all over the place. Chaos is obviously the next step, except that Noah believed. And if one person believes, grace can enter the world. It can't if no one does, because God doesn't control it. God loves the world. Somebody, every family, if they've got a saint in it, that's fine, that's great, because it opens to the miraculous love of God. These chapters focus on the limits within which they and we must live. If they're going to build a faithful community in post-exilic Judah, they should live wisely, attentive to God's directions. If they don't, they're in danger of bringing upon themselves a repetition of the destruction of Jerusalem and the temple and the suffering of the exile. Banished from the garden. The correct question to ask ourselves as we read Genesis 1 to 11 is not, what's the meaning of these past events for us today? The correct question is, what are the authors saying about the human condition? About what it means to be man and woman and a creator, creature of God. The authors of Genesis are obviously interested in history, they're interested in human behaviour, they're interested in responsible action, here formalised as the description of the human being as such, which is Adam. They've got a special word for man, male, is Ish, and Isha is female. Adam always means everyone, us. Now, as the story goes, Adam, at one stage of the story, gets applied to the male, which makes it a bit tricky to read it. And Eve gets another name. But basically, Adam means the human race. They assert that we're inclined towards evil, which we know. But they reiterate their conviction that Yahweh is ultimately involved in human history. The divine mercy, as has just been demonstrated in the return from exile, transcends our sin. So they needed these stories to encourage them to not give up and to keep their faith. We need them too. Genesis chapter 5 introduced a list of those who were generated from Adam. For the ancients, importance is measured by antiquity. The ultimate aim of the authors is to demonstrate that the people of Israel go right back to the beginnings of history. This genealogy comes from the priestly school. So David, go further back, and you end up with Abram, then you end up with Adam. So where the pure line, we the Jews. The key aim of the authors is to locate history, beginning with Abram, with God's promise of blessing on the human race, while highlighting the immeasurable vastness of the development of humanity prior to Abraham. In the myths of the ancient Near East, the story of the beginnings leads directly, if you read any of them, the ancient Near Eastern texts, they're available, the story of the beginnings leads directly to the establishment of the monarchy. That's where it all ends up, the monarchy. Their purpose was to provide a stable and divine foundation for the king's reign, supported by the religious cult, the worship of the people. As we've already noted, the stories at the beginning of Genesis don't take the form of myth. Their purpose is different. The primeval narrative in Genesis doesn't reach a climax with the king and the cult. It introduces the patriarchs, the ancient ancestors of the people of Israel. And in fact, the climax of it, from the priestly point of view, was the Sabbath. The blessing of the sixth day was the Sabbath. The seventh day God rested. So the Sabbath becomes the, only in the exile, not before, and in post-exilic Judah, the Sabbath becomes the sacred creation of God, the climax of God's creation. And isn't it stunning that here, 2,000 years later, for the Jewish community, the Sabbath is still so central? We haven't got a Sabbath. We've got a different thing. We've got a Sunday Mass. We've got the Sunday, the first day of the week. Because ours isn't like resting at the end. It's starting a whole missionary thing, a whole new world, a new heaven, a new earth, a new mission. So it's Christianity is a missionary religion, and we bring in bits of the Sabbath, of course, but it's not actually a Sabbath day, it's the first day of the week. Just as Christians read the Old Testament in the light of Jesus' revelation, so the people of Israel read these patriarchal stories in the light of the revelation given to Moses. They were a kind of... Genesis 1, now Genesis, they were a kind of Old Testament for them, in which they expected to find material that was preparation for, but not always consistent with, their own religious practices as spelled out in the other books of the Torah. This is particularly noticeable in the way God and God's relationship to human beings are portrayed in the patriarchal narratives. There's no sense of religious antagonism. Other nations are not rejected because they worship false gods. There's deep respect for Egypt and for Ur of the Chaldees and so on. It's not an antagonistic text at all. It's very open. Everyone's aiming to be assumed to be relating to the one God. This is true of Abraham, Isaac and Jacob, but it's also true of Abimelech, a Canaanite king, and the Pharaoh of Egypt. They're all presented as really good people. Furthermore, God relates to people directly in these stories, without the mediation of priests or prophets. There are no priests, prophets. The exception, of course, is Melchizedek, but he appears strangely in a few verses and then vanishes. Cult is simply family cult, which it would have been in the ancient times, quite different from Mosaic Yahwism. Quite different from what you find in Exodus, etc. Some of this comes from the fidelity of the authors to the ancient stories that they've received and are handing on. Some of it comes from quite subtle theological reflection as they move from once upon a time, which is a good way to begin the book of Genesis, once upon a time, not in a time, portrayal of God in the primeval narrative through the patriarchal period and up to the revelation of Moses. The book of Genesis is a book of inspired and insightful human stories and human reflections. These stories don't give us one true, complete or final revelation of how God relates to us and how we should respond. The picture they present is rich and varied. The post-exilic authors have a vision of Israel and Judah that transcended their own experiences and their own time. The way God is portrayed as relating to human beings and the way religion is expressed in the primeval narrative and in the patriarchal narrative is significantly different from the way God is portrayed and religion expressed in the books that aim to capture the essence of Mosaic Yahwism. Though it's clear that the post-exilic authors have adapted the stories, orally transmitted or some already written, to speak to the needs of a much later time than that of the patriarchs or Moses, they wanted to present an understanding of God and of God's relationship to the people of Israel, indeed to the world, that reflects the different periods of their history till it reached its highest point in the revelation given to Moses on Mount Sinai. There are some quotes in the New Testament, as you'd expect, from the book of Genesis. Jesus answered, we're told, Matthew 19, have you not read that the one who made them at the beginning made them male and female? For this reason a man shall leave his father and mother and be joined to his wife, and the two become one flesh. Quoting from the book of Genesis. It's written, this is Paul to the Corinthians, the first man, Adam, became a living being. And you know the story. God, the potter, takes the dust, by the way, not the clay, takes the dust of the earth. How you make a pottery thing out of dust beats me, but that's the point of the story. If it was clay, well, you could shove it on the mantelpiece, it'd still be there thousands of years later. But if God created us out of dust, then God has to keep his hands there, holding us. Because if he took his hands away, it's all just gone. So it's a powerful image. But when he makes us out of dust, he's got us quite close and he's holding us in his hands as we are. That's not all we are. We have something else as well. God breathes his spirit into this dust and we become this extraordinary human being, fragile as anything, but dreaming of the infinite, enormous energy of soul, of spirit, all in one. Hebrews 11:5, by faith Enoch was taken, one of the stories, so that he didn't experience death. Enoch was swept up to heaven somewhere. And he was not found because God had taken him. It's a little beginning of a glimmer to think that death can't be the end. There's got to be more to life than death. It can't finish it. And so you've got this extraordinary story of Enoch being swept up. Or maybe it could happen to us. And then you've got the better story even later of Elijah taken up in the fiery chariot. He's not dead, he's going to come back. And you know that story. So I conclude now with some music.